The basis of all modern discussions of time travel is Einstein's general theory of relativity. As we've seen in earlier chapters, the Einstein equations made space and time dynamic by describing how they were curved and distorted by the matter and energy in the universe. In general relativity, someone's personal time, as measured by their wristwatch, would always increase, just as it did in Newtonian theory or the flat space-time of special relativity. But there was now the possibility that space-time could be warped so much that you could go off in a spaceship and come back before you set out. One way this could happen is if there were wormholes, tubes of space-time mentioned in Chapter 4 that connect different regions of space and time. The idea is that you steer your spaceship into one mouth of the wormhole and come out of the other mouth in a different place and at a different time. Wormholes, if they exist, would be the solution to the speed limit problem in space. It would take tens of thousands of years to cross the galaxy in a spaceship that travelled at less than the speed of light, as relativity demands. But you might go through a wormhole to the other side of the galaxy and be back in time for dinner. However, one can show that if wormholes exist, you could also use them to get back before you set out. So you might think that you could do something like blowing up the rocket on its launch pad to prevent your setting out in the first place. This is a variation of the grandfather paradox. What happens if you go back and kill your grandfather before your father was conceived? Of course, this is a paradox only if you believe you have free will to do what you like when you go back in time. This book will not go into a philosophical discussion of free will. Instead, it'll concentrate on whether the laws of physics allow space-time to be so warped that a macroscopic body, such as a spaceship, can return to its own past. According to Einstein's theory, a spaceship necessarily travels at less than the local speed of light and follows what's called a time-like path through space-time. Thus, one can formulate the question in technical terms: does space-time admit time-like curves that are closed, that is, that return to their starting point again and again? I shall refer to such paths as time loops. There are three levels on which we can try to answer this question. The first is Einstein's general theory of relativity, which assumes that the universe has a well-defined history without any uncertainty. For this classical theory, we have a fairly complete picture. However, as we've seen, this theory can't be quite right because we observe that matter is subject to uncertainty and quantum fluctuations. We can therefore ask the question about time travel on a second level, that of semi-classical theory. In this, we consider matter to behave according to quantum theory, with uncertainty and quantum fluctuations, but space-time to be well-defined and classical. Here, the picture is less complete, but at least we have some idea of how to proceed. Finally, there is the full quantum theory of gravity, whatever that may be. In this theory, where not just matter but also time and space themselves are uncertain and fluctuate, it's not even clear how to pose the question of whether time travel is possible. Maybe the best we can do is to ask how people in regions where space-time is nearly classical and free from uncertainty would interpret their measurements. Would they think that time travel had taken place in regions of strong gravity and large quantum fluctuations? To start with the classical theory, the flat space-time of special relativity, relativity without gravity, doesn't allow time travel, nor do the curved space-times that were known early on. It was therefore a great shock to Einstein when, in 1949, Kurt Gödel of Gödel's theorem discovered a space-time that was a universe full of rotating matter, with time loops through every point. Gödel's incompleteness theorem. In 1931, the mathematician Kurt Gödel proved his famous incompleteness theorem about the nature of mathematics. The theorem states that within any formal system of axioms, such as present-day mathematics, questions always persist that can neither be proved or disproved on the basis of the axioms that define the system. In other words, Gödel showed that there are problems that cannot be solved by any set of rules or procedures. Gödel's theorem set fundamental limits on mathematics. It came as a great shock to the scientific community, since it overthrew the widespread belief that mathematics was a coherent and complete system based on a single logical foundation. Gödel's theorem, together with Heisenberg's uncertainty principle and chaos theory, form a core set of limitations to scientific knowledge that came to be appreciated only during the 20th century. The Gödel solution required a cosmological constant, which may or may not exist in nature. But other solutions were subsequently found without a cosmological constant. A particularly interesting case is one in which two cosmic strings move at high speed past each other. Cosmic strings. Cosmic strings are long, heavy objects with a tiny cross-section that may have been produced during the early stages of the universe. Once cosmic strings formed, they were further stretched by the expansion of the universe, and by now a single cosmic string could cross over the entire length of our observable universe. The occurrence of cosmic strings is suggested by modern theories of particles, which predict that in the hot, early stages of the universe, matter was in a symmetric phase, much like liquid water, which is symmetrical, the same at every point in every direction, rather than like ice crystals, which have a discrete structure. When the universe cooled, the symmetry of the early phase could have been broken in different ways in distant regions. Consequently, the cosmic matter would have settled into different ground states in those regions. Cosmic strings are the configurations of matter at the boundaries between these regions. Their formation was therefore an inevitable consequence of the fact that different regions could not agree on their ground states. Cosmic strings should not be confused with the strings of string theory, though they are not entirely unrelated. They're objects with length, but a tiny cross-section. Their occurrence is predicted in some theories of elementary particles. The space-time outside a single cosmic string is flat. However, it's flat space-time with a wedge cut out, with the sharp end of the wedge at the string. It's like a cone. Take a large circle of paper and cut out a segment like a slice of pie, a wedge with its corner at the center of the circle. Then discard the piece you've cut out and glue the cut edges of the remaining piece together so that you have a cone. This represents the space-time in which the cosmic string exists. Notice that because the surface of the cone is the same flat sheet of paper with which you started, minus the wedge, you can still call it flat, except at the apex. You can recognize that there is curvature at the apex by the fact that a circle round the apex has a smaller circumference than a circle drawn at the same distance round the center of the original round sheet of paper. In other words, a circle round the apex is shorter than one would expect for a circle of that radius in flat space because of the missing segment. Similarly, in the case of a cosmic string, the wedge that is removed from flat space-time shortens circles round the string but doesn't affect time or distances along the string. This means that the space-time around a single cosmic string doesn't contain any time loops, so it's not possible to travel into the past. However, if there's a second cosmic string that is moving relative to the first, its time direction will be a combination of the time and space directions of the first. This means that the wedge that is cut out for the second string will shorten both distances in space and time intervals as seen by someone moving with the first string. If the cosmic strings are moving at nearly the speed of light relative to each other, the saving of time going around both strings can be so great that one arrives back before one set out. In other words, there are time loops that one can follow to travel into the past. The cosmic string space-time contains matter that has positive energy density and is consistent with the physics we know. However, the warping that produces the time loops extends all the way out to infinity in space and back to the infinite past in time. Thus, these space-times were created with time travel in them. We have no reason to believe that our own universe was created in such a warped fashion, and we have no reliable evidence of visitors from the future. I'm discounting the conspiracy theory that UFOs are from the future and that the government knows and is covering it up. Its record of cover-ups is not that good. I shall therefore assume that there were no time loops in the distant past, or more precisely, in the past of some surface through space-time, that I shall call S. The question then is, could some advanced civilization build a time machine, That is, could it modify the space-time to the future of S, so that time loops appeared in a finite region? I say a finite region because no matter how advanced the civilization becomes, it could presumably control only a finite part of the universe. In science, finding the right formulation of a problem is often the key to solving it, and this was a good example. To define what was meant by a finite time machine, I went back to some early work of mine. Time travel is possible in a region of space-time in which there are time loops, paths that move at less than the speed of light, but which nevertheless manage to come back to the place and time they started, because of the warping of space-time. Since I've assumed that there were no time loops in the distant past, there must be what I call a time travel horizon, the boundary separating the region of time loops from the region without them. Time travel horizons are rather like black hole horizons. While a black hole horizon is formed by light rays that just miss falling into the black hole, a time travel horizon is formed by light rays on the verge of meeting up with themselves. I then take as my criterion for a time machine what I call a finitely generated horizon. That is, a horizon which is formed by light rays that all emerge from a bounded region. In other words, they don't come in from infinity or from a singularity, but originate from a finite region containing time loops, the sort of region our advanced civilization is supposed to create. In adopting this definition as the footprint of a time machine, we have the advantage of being able to use the machinery that Roger Penrose and I developed to study singularities and black holes. Even without using the Einstein equations, I can show that in general, a finitely generated horizon will contain a light ray that actually meets up with itself. That is, a light ray that keeps coming back to the same point over and over again. Each time the light came round, it would be more and more blue-shifted, so the images would get bluer and bluer. The wave crests of a pulse of light will get closer and closer together, and the light will get around in shorter and shorter intervals of its time. In fact, a particle of light would have only a finite history, as defined by its own measure of time, even though it went around and around in a finite region and didn't hit a curvature, singularity. One might not care if a particle of light completed its history in a finite time, but I can also prove that there would be paths moving at less than the speed of light that had only finite duration. These could be the histories of observers who would be trapped in a finite region before the horizon and would go around and around faster and faster until they reached the speed of light in a finite time. So, if a beautiful alien in a flying saucer invites you into her time machine, step with care. You might fall into one of these trapped repeating histories of only finite duration. These results don't depend on the Einstein equations, but only on the way space-time would have to warp to produce time loops in a finite region. However, we can now ask what kind of matter an advanced civilization would have to use to warp space-time so as to build a finite-sized time machine. Can it have positive energy density everywhere, as in the cosmic string space-time I described earlier? Cosmic string space-time didn't satisfy my requirement that the time loops appear in a finite region. However, one might think that this was just because the cosmic strings were infinitely long. One might imagine that one could build a finite time machine using finite loops of cosmic string and have the energy density positive everywhere. It's a pity to disappoint people such as Kip, who want to return to the past, but it can't be done with positive energy density everywhere. I can prove that to build a finite time machine, you need negative energy. Energy density is always positive in classical theory, so time machines of finite size are ruled out on this level. However, the situation is different in the semi-classical theory, in which one considers matter to behave according to quantum theory, but space-time to be well-defined and classical. As we've seen, the uncertainty principle of quantum theory means that fields are always fluctuating up and down, even in apparently empty space, and have an energy density that is infinite. Thus one has to subtract an infinite quantity to get the finite energy density that we observe in the universe. This subtraction can leave the energy density negative, at least locally. Even in flat space, one can find quantum states in which the energy density is negative locally, although the total energy is positive. One might wonder whether these negative values actually cause space-time to warp in the appropriate way to build a finite time machine. But it seems they must. As we saw in Chapter 4, quantum fluctuations mean that even apparently empty space is full of pairs of virtual particles that appear together, move apart, and then come back together and annihilate each other. One member of a virtual particle pair will have positive energy and the other negative energy. When a black hole is present, the negative energy member can fall in and the positive energy member can escape to infinity, where it appears as radiation that carries positive energy away from the black hole. The negative energy particles falling in cause the black hole to lose mass and to evaporate slowly, with its horizon shrinking in size. Ordinary matter with positive energy density has an attractive gravitational effect and warps space-time to bend light rays toward each other, just as the ball on the rubber sheet in Chapter 2 always makes the smaller ball bearings curve toward it, never away. This would imply that the area of the horizon of a black hole could only increase with time, never shrink. For the horizon of a black hole to shrink in size, the energy density on the horizon must be negative and warp space-time to make light rays diverge from each other. This was something I first realized when I was getting into bed soon after the birth of my daughter. I won't say how long ago that was, but I now have a grandson. The evaporation of black holes shows that on the quantum level, the energy density can sometimes be negative and warp space-time in the direction that would be needed to build a time machine. Thus, we might imagine that some very advanced civilization could arrange things so that the energy density is sufficiently negative to form a time machine that could be used by macroscopic objects, such as spaceships. However, there's an important difference between a black hole horizon, which is formed by light rays that just keep going, and the horizon in a time machine, which contains closed light rays that keep going around and around. A virtual particle moving on such a closed path will bring its ground state energy back to the same point again and again. One would therefore expect the energy density to be infinite on the horizon, the boundary of the time machine, the region in which one can travel into the past. This is borne out by explicit calculations in a few backgrounds that are simple enough for exact calculations. It would mean that a person or a space probe that tried to cross the horizon to get into the time machine would get wiped out by a bolt of radiation. So the future looks black for time travel, or should one say, blindingly white. The energy density of matter depends on the state it is in, so it is possible that an advanced civilization might be able to make the energy density finite on the boundary of the time machine by freezing out or removing the virtual particles that go around and around in a closed loop. It's not clear, however, that such a time machine would be stable. The least disturbance, such as someone crossing the horizon to enter the time machine, might set off circulating virtual particles and trigger a bolt of lightning. This is a question that physicists should be free to discuss without being laughed to scorn. Even if it turns out that time travel is impossible, it's important that we understand why it is impossible. To answer that question definitely, we need to consider quantum fluctuations, not only of matter fields, but of space-time itself. One might expect that these would cause a certain fuzziness in the paths of light rays and in the whole concept of time ordering. Indeed, one can regard the radiation from black holes as leaking out because quantum fluctuations of space-time mean that the horizon is not exactly defined. Because we don't yet have a complete theory of quantum gravity, it's difficult to say what the effects of space-time fluctuation should be. Nevertheless, we can hope to get some pointers from the Feynman sum over histories described in Chapter 3. Each history will be a curved space-time with matter fields in it. Since we're supposed to sum over all possible histories, not just those that satisfy some equations, the sum must include space-times that are warped enough for travel into the past. So the question is, why isn't time travel happening everywhere? The answer is that time travel is indeed taking place on a microscopic scale, but we don't notice it. If one applies the Feynman sum over histories idea to a particle, one has to include histories in which the particle travels faster than light and even backward in time. In particular, there will be histories in which the particle goes around and around on a closed loop in time and space. It will be like the film Groundhog Day, in which a reporter has to live the same day over and over again. One can't observe particles with such closed-loop histories directly with a particle detector. However, the indirect effects have been measured in a number of experiments. One is a small shift in the light given out by hydrogen atoms, caused by electrons moving in closed loops. Another is a small force between parallel metal plates, caused by the fact that there are slightly fewer closed-loop histories that can fit between the plates, compared to the region outside. Another equivalent interpretation of the Casimir effect. Thus, the existence of closed-loop histories is confirmed by experiment. One might dispute whether closed-loop particle histories have anything to do with the warping of space-time, because they occur even in fixed backgrounds such as flat space. But in recent years, we've found that phenomena in physics often have dual, equally valid descriptions. One can equally well say that a particle moves on a closed loop in a given fixed background, or that the particle stays fixed, and space and time fluctuate around it. It's just a question of whether you do the sum over particle paths first, and then the sum over curved spacetimes, or vice versa. It seems, therefore, that quantum theory allows time travel on a microscopic scale. However, this is not much use for science fiction purposes, such as going back and killing your grandfather. The question, therefore, is, can the probability in the sum over histories be peaked around spacetimes with macroscopic time loops? One can investigate this question by studying the sum over histories of matter fields in a series of background spacetimes that get closer and closer to admitting time loops. One would expect something dramatic to happen when time loops first appear, and this is borne out in a simple example that I studied with my student Michael Cassidy. The background spacetimes in the series we studied were closely related to what is called the Einstein universe, the spacetime that Einstein proposed when he believed that the universe was static and unchanging in time, neither expanding nor contracting. See Chapter 1. In the Einstein universe, time runs from the infinite past to the infinite future. The space directions, however, are finite and close on themselves, like the surface of the Earth, but with one more dimension. One can picture this space-time as a cylinder with the long axis being the time direction and the cross-section being the three space directions. The Einstein universe doesn't represent the universe we live in because it's not expanding. Nevertheless, it is a convenient background to use when discussing time travel, because it's simple enough that one can do the sum over histories. Forgetting about time travel for a moment, consider matter in an Einstein universe that is rotating about some axis. If you were on the axis, you could remain at the same point of space, just as you do when standing at the center of a children's carousel. But if you were not on the axis, you would be moving through space as you rotated about the axis. The further you were from the axis, the faster you would be moving. So if the universe were infinite in space, points sufficiently far from the axis would have to be rotating faster than light. However, because the Einstein universe is finite in the space directions, there is a critical rate of rotation below which no part of the universe is rotating faster than light. Now consider the sum over particle histories in a rotating Einstein universe. When the rotation is slow, there are many paths a particle can take using a given amount of energy. Thus, the sum over all particle histories in this background gives a large amplitude. This means that the probability of this background would be high in the sum over all curved spacetime histories. That is, it's among the more probable histories. However, as the rate of rotation of the Einstein universe approaches the critical value, so that its outer edges are moving at a speed approaching the speed of light, there is only one particle path that is classically allowed on that edge, namely, one that is moving at the speed of light. This means that the sum over particle histories will be small. Thus, the probability of these backgrounds will be low in the sum over all curved spacetime histories. That is, they are the least probable. What do rotating Einstein universes have to do with time travel and time loops? The answer is that they're mathematically equivalent to other backgrounds that do admit time loops. These other backgrounds are universes that are expanding in two space directions. The universes are not expanding in the third space direction, which is periodic. That is to say, if you go a certain distance in this direction, you get back to where you started. However, each time you do a circuit of the third space direction, your speed in the first or second directions gets boosted. If the boost is small, there are no time loops. However, consider a sequence of backgrounds with increasing boosts in speed. At a certain critical boost, time loops will appear. Not surprisingly, this critical boost corresponds to the critical rate of rotation of the Einstein universes. Since the sum over history's calculations in these backgrounds are mathematically equivalent, one can conclude that the probability of these backgrounds goes to zero as they approach the warping needed for time loops. In other words, the probability of having sufficient warping for a time machine is zero. This supports what I've called the chronology protection conjecture, mentioned at the end of Chapter 2, that the laws of physics conspire to prevent time travel by macroscopic objects. Although time loops are allowed by the sum over histories, the probabilities are extremely small. Based on the duality arguments I mentioned earlier, I estimate the probability that Kip Thorne could go back and kill his grandfather as less than 1 in 10 with a trillion, 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 trillion zeros after it. As gambling men, Kip and I would bet on odds like that. The trouble is, we can't bet each other because we're now both on the same side. On the other hand, I wouldn't take a bet with anyone else. He might be from the future and know that time travel worked. You might wonder if this chapter is part of a government cover-up on time travel. You might be right. Chapter 6. Our future. Star Trek or not? How biological and electronic life will go on developing in complexity at an ever-increasing rate. The reason Star Trek is so popular is because it's a safe and comforting vision of the future. I'm a bit of a Star Trek fan myself, so I was easily persuaded to take part in an episode in which I played poker with Newton, Einstein, and Commander Data. I beat them all, but unfortunately there was a red alert, so I never collected my winnings. Star Trek shows a society that is far in advance of ours in science, in technology, and in political organization. The last might not be difficult. There must have been great changes, with their accompanying tensions and upsets, in the time between now and then. But in the period we're shown, science, technology, and the organization of society are supposed to have achieved a level of near perfection. I want to question this picture and ask if we will ever reach a final steady state in science and technology. At no time in the 10,000 years or so since the last ice age has the human race been in a state of constant knowledge and fixed technology. There have been a few setbacks, like the Dark Ages after the fall of the Roman Empire, but the world's population, which is a measure of our technological ability to preserve life and feed ourselves, has risen steadily, with only a few hiccups, such as the Black Death. In the last 200 years, population growth has become exponential. That is, the population grows by the same percentage each year. Currently, the rate is about 1.9% a year. That may not sound like very much, but it means that the world population doubles every 40 years. Other measures of technological development in recent times are electricity consumption and the number of scientific articles. They too show exponential growth, with doubling times of less than 40 years. There's no sign that scientific and technological development will slow down and stop in the near future, certainly not by the time of Star Trek, which is supposed to be not that far in the future. But if the population growth and the increase in the consumption of electricity continue at their current rates, by 2600, the world's population will be standing shoulder to shoulder, and electricity use will make the Earth glow red hot. If you stacked all the new books being published next to each other, you would have to move at 90 miles an hour just to keep up with the end of the line. Of course, by 2600, new artistic and scientific work will come in electronic forms rather than as physical books and papers. Nevertheless, if the exponential growth continued, there would be 10 papers a second in my kind of theoretical physics, and no time to read them. Clearly, the present exponential growth can't continue indefinitely. So what will happen? One possibility is that we'll wipe ourselves out completely by some disaster, such as a nuclear war. There's a sick joke that the reason we've not been contacted by extraterrestrials is that when a civilization reaches our stage of development, it becomes unstable and destroys itself. However, I'm an optimist. I don't believe the human race has come so far just to snuff itself out when things are getting interesting. The Star Trek vision of the future, that we achieve an advanced but essentially static level, may come true in respect of our knowledge of the basic laws that govern the universe. As I shall describe in the next chapter, there may be an ultimate theory that we'll discover in the not-too-distant future. This ultimate theory, if it exists, will determine whether the Star Trek dream of warp drive can be realized. According to present ideas, we shall have to explore the galaxy in a slow and tedious manner, using spaceships traveling slower than light. But since we don't yet have a complete unified theory, we can't quite rule out warp drive. On the other hand, we already know the laws that hold in all but the most extreme situations, the laws that govern the crew of the Enterprise, if not the spaceship itself. Yet it doesn't seem that we'll ever reach a steady state in the uses we make of these laws, or in the complexity of the systems that we can produce with them. It is with this complexity that the rest of this chapter will be concerned. By far the most complex systems that we have are our own bodies. Life seems to have originated in the primordial oceans that covered the Earth 4 billion years ago. How this happened, we don't know. It may be that random collisions between atoms built up macromolecules that could reproduce themselves and assemble themselves into more complicated structures. What we do know is that by 3.5 billion years ago, the highly complicated DNA molecule had emerged. DNA is the basis for all life on Earth. It has a double helix structure, like a spiral staircase, which was discovered by Francis Crick and James Watson in the Cavendish Lab at Cambridge in 1953. The two strands of the double helix are linked by pairs of nucleic acids, like the treads in a spiral staircase. There are four kinds of nucleic acids: cytosine, guanine, tyrosine, and adenosine. The order in which the different nucleic acids occur along the spiral staircase carries the genetic information that enables the DNA molecule to assemble an organism around it and reproduce itself. As the DNA makes copies of itself, there are occasional errors in the order of the nucleic acids along the spiral. In most cases, the mistakes in copying make the DNA either unable or less likely to reproduce itself, meaning that such genetic errors or mutations, as they're called, will die out. But in a few cases, the error or mutation will increase the chances of the DNA surviving and reproducing. Such changes in the genetic code will be favored. This is how the information contained in the sequence of nucleic acids gradually evolves and increases in complexity. Because biological evolution is basically a random walk in the space of all genetic possibilities, it's been very slow. The complexity, or numbers of bits of information that is coded in DNA, is roughly the number of nucleic acids in the molecule. For the first 2 billion years or so, the rate of increase in complexity must have been of the order of one bit of information every 100 years. The rate of increase of DNA complexity gradually rose to about one bit a year over the last few million years. But then, about 6 or 8 thousand years ago, a major new development occurred. We developed written language. This meant that information could be passed from one generation to the next without having to wait for the very slow process of random mutations and natural selection to code it into the DNA sequence. The amount of complexity increased enormously. A single paperback romance could hold as much information as the difference in the DNA between apes and humans, and a 30-volume encyclopedia could describe the entire sequence of human DNA. Even more important, the information in books can be updated rapidly. The current rate at which human DNA is being updated by biological evolution is about one bit a year. but there are 200,000 new books published each year, a new information rate of over a million bits a second. Of course, most of this information is garbage, but even if only one bit in a million is useful, that is still 100,000 times faster than biological evolution. This transmission of data through external, non-biological means has led the human race to dominate the world and to have an exponentially increasing population. But now we're at the beginning of a new era in which we'll be able to increase the complexity of our internal record, the DNA, without having to wait for the slow process of biological evolution. There has been no significant change in human DNA in the last 10,000 years, but it is likely that we'll be able to completely redesign it in the next 1,000. Of course, many people will say the genetic engineering of humans should be banned, but it's doubtful we'll be able to prevent it. Genetic engineering of plants and animals will be allowed for economic reasons, and someone is bound to try it on humans. Unless we have a totalitarian world order, someone somewhere will design improved humans. Clearly, creating improved humans will create great social and political problems with respect to unimproved humans. My intention is not to defend human genetic engineering as a desirable development, but just to say it's likely to happen whether we want it or not. This is the reason why I don't believe science fiction like Star Trek, where people 400 years into the future are essentially the same as we are today. I think the human race and its DNA will increase its complexity quite rapidly. We should recognize that this is likely to happen and consider how we'll deal with it. In a way, the human race needs to improve its mental and physical qualities if it's to deal with the increasingly complex world around it and meet new challenges such as space travel. Humans also need to increase their complexity if biological systems are to keep ahead of electronic ones. At the moment, computers have the advantage of speed, but they show no sign of intelligence. And this is not surprising, because our present computers are less complex than the brain of an earthworm, a species not noted for its intellectual powers. But computers obey what is known as Moore's Law. Their speed and complexity double every 18 months. It's one of those exponential growths that clearly can't continue indefinitely. However, it will probably continue until computers have a complexity similar to that of the human brain. Some people say that computers can never show true intelligence, whatever that may be. But it seems to me that if very complicated chemical molecules can operate in humans to make them intelligent, then equally complicated electronic circuits can also make computers act in an intelligent way. And if they're intelligent, they can presumably design computers that have an even greater complexity and intelligence. Will this increase of biological and electronic complexity go on forever, or is there a natural limit? On the biological side, the limit on human intelligence up to now has been set by the size of the brain that will pass through the birth canal. Having watched my three children being born, I know how difficult it is for the head to get out. But within the next 100 years, I expect we'll be able to grow babies outside the human body, so this limitation will be removed. Ultimately, however, increases in the size of the human brain through genetic engineering will come up against the problem that the body's chemical messengers, responsible for our mental activity, are relatively slow-moving. This means that further increases in the complexity of the brain will be at the expense of speed. We can be quick-witted or very intelligent, but not both. Still, I think we can become a lot more intelligent than most of the people in Star Trek. Not that that might be difficult. Electronic circuits have the same complexity versus speed problem as the human brain. In this case, however, the signals are electrical, not chemical, and travel at the speed of light, which is much higher. Nevertheless, the speed of light is already a practical limit on the design of faster computers. One can improve the situation by making the circuits smaller, but ultimately there'll be a limit set by the atomic nature of matter. Still, we have some way to go before we meet that barrier. Another way in which electronic circuits can increase their complexity while maintaining speed is to copy the human brain. The brain does not have a single CPU, central processing unit, that processes each command in sequence. Rather, it has millions of processes working together at the same time. Such massively parallel processing will be the future for electronic intelligence as well. Assuming we don't destroy ourselves in the next 100 years, it is likely that we'll spread out first to the planets in the solar system and then to the nearby stars. But it won't be like Star Trek or Babylon 5, with a new race of nearly human beings in almost every stellar system. The human race has been in its present form for only 2 million years, out of 15 billion years or so since the Big Bang. The biological electronic interface. Within 2 decades, a $1,000 computer may be as complex as the human brain. Parallel processors could mimic the way our brain works and make computers act in intelligent and conscious ways. Neural implants may allow a much faster interface between the brain and computers, dissolving the distance between biological and electronic intelligence. In the near future, most business transactions will probably be made between cyber personalities via the World Wide Web. Within a decade, many of us may even choose to live a virtual existence on the net, forming cyber friendships and relationships. Our understanding of the human genome will undoubtedly create great medical advances, but it will also enable us to increase the complexity of the human DNA structure significantly. In the next few 100 years, human genetic engineering will replace biological evolution, redesigning the human race and posing entirely new ethical questions. Space travel beyond our solar system will probably require either genetically engineered humans or unmanned computer-controlled probes. So even if life develops in other stellar systems, the chances of catching it at a recognizably human stage are very small. Any alien life we encounter will likely be either much more primitive or much more advanced. If it is more advanced, why hasn't it spread through the galaxy and visited Earth? If aliens had come here, it should have been more obvious, more like the film Independence Day than E.T. So how does one account for our lack of extraterrestrial visitors? It could be that there is an advanced race out there which is aware of our existence, but is leaving us to stew in our own primitive juices. However, it is doubtful it would be so considerate to a lower life form. Do most of us worry about how many insects and earthworms we squash underfoot? A more reasonable explanation is that there is a very low probability either of life developing on other planets or of that life developing intelligence. Because we claim to be intelligent, though perhaps without much ground, we tend to see intelligence as an inevitable consequence of evolution. However, one can question that. It's not clear that intelligence has much survival value. Bacteria do very well without intelligence and will survive us if our so-called intelligence causes us to wipe ourselves out in a nuclear war. So, as we explore the galaxy, we may find primitive life, but we're not likely to find beings like us. The future of science won't be like the comforting picture painted in Star Trek, a universe populated by many humanoid races with an advanced but essentially static science and technology. Instead, I think we'll be on our own, but rapidly developing in biological and electronic complexity. Not much of this will happen in the next 100 years, which is all we can reliably predict. But by the end of the next millennium, if we get there, the difference from Star Trek will be fundamental. Chapter 7. Brain New World. Do we live on a brain, or are we just holograms? How will our journey of discovery proceed in the future? Will we succeed in our quest for a complete unified theory that will govern the universe and everything that it contains? In fact, as described in Chapter 2, we may have already identified the theory of everything, TOE, as M-theory. This theory doesn't have a single formulation, at least as far as we know. Instead, we've discovered a network of apparently different theories which all seem to be approximations to the same underlying fundamental theory in different limits, just as Newton's theory of gravity is an approximation to Einstein's general theory of relativity in the limit that the gravitational field is weak. M-theory is like a jigsaw. It's easiest to identify and fit together the pieces round the edges of the jigsaw, the limits of M-theory where some quantity or other is small. We now have a fairly good idea of these edges, but there is still a gaping hole at the centre of the M-theory jigsaw, where we don't know what's going on. We can't really claim to have found the theory of everything until we have filled that hole. What is in the centre of M-theory? Will we discover dragons or something equally strange, like on old maps of unexplored lands? Our experience in the past suggests we're likely to find unexpected new phenomena whenever we extend the range of our observations to smaller scales. At the beginning of the 20th century, we understood the workings of nature on the scales of classical physics, which is good from interstellar distances down to about 1/100 of a millimeter. Classical physics assumes that matter is a continuous medium with properties like elasticity and viscosity. But evidence began to emerge that matter is not smooth, but grainy. It's made of tiny building blocks called atoms. The word atom comes from Greek and means indivisible, but it was soon found that atoms consisted of electrons orbiting a nucleus made up of protons and neutrons. The work on atomic physics in the first 30 years of the 20th century took our understanding down to lengths of 1/1000000th of a millimeter. Then we discovered that protons and neutrons are made of even smaller particles called quarks. Our recent research on nuclear and high-energy physics has taken us to length scales that are smaller by a further factor of 1 billion. It might seem that we could go on forever discovering structures on smaller and smaller length scales. However, there is a limit to this series, as there is to the series of Russian dolls within Russian dolls. Eventually, one gets down to a smallest doll, which can't be taken apart anymore. In physics, the smallest doll is called the Planck length. To probe to shorter distances would require particles of such high energy that they were inside black holes. We don't know exactly what the fundamental Planck length is in M-theory, but it might be as small as 1 millimeter divided by 100,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000, distances that small. They would have to be larger than the solar system, and they're not likely to be approved in the present financial climate. However, there has been an exciting new development that means we might discover at least some of the dragons of M-theory more easily and cheaply. As explained in chapters 2 and 3, in the M-theory network of mathematical models, space-time has 10 or 11 dimensions. Up to recently, it was thought that the 6 or 7 extra dimensions would all be curled up very small. It would be like a human hair. If you look at a hair under a magnifying glass, you can see it has thickness. But to the naked eye, it just appears like a line with length, but no other dimension. Space-time may be similar. On human, atomic, or even nuclear physics length scales, it may appear four-dimensional and nearly flat. On the other hand, if we probe to very short distances using extremely high-energy particles, we should see that space-time was 10 or 11-dimensional. Brain worlds. If all the additional dimensions were very small, it would be very difficult to observe them. However, there has recently been the suggestion that one or more of the extra dimensions might be comparatively large or even infinite. This idea has the great advantage, at least to a positivist like me, that it may be testable by the next generation of particle accelerators or by sensitive short-range measurements of the gravitational force. Such observations could either falsify the theory or experimentally confirm the presence of other dimensions. Large extra dimensions are an exciting new development in our search for the ultimate model or theory. They would imply that we lived in a brain world, a four-dimensional surface or brain in a higher-dimensional space-time. Matter and non-gravitational forces, like the electric force, would be confined to the brain. Thus, everything not involving gravity would behave as it would in four dimensions. In particular, the electric force between the nucleus of an atom and the electrons orbiting around it would fall off with distance at the right rate for atoms to be stable against the electrons falling into the nucleus. This would be in accordance with the anthropic principle that the universe must be suitable for intelligent life. If atoms weren't stable, we wouldn't be here to observe the universe and ask why it appears four-dimensional. On the other hand, gravity in the form of curved space would permeate the whole bulk of the higher-dimensional space-time. This would mean that gravity would behave differently from other forces we experience. Because gravity would spread out in the extra dimensions, it would fall off more rapidly with distance than one would expect. If this more rapid fall-off of the gravitational force extended to astronomical distances, we would have noticed its effect on the orbits of the planets. In fact, they would be unstable, as was remarked in Chapter 3. The planets would either fall into the Sun or escape to the dark and cold of interstellar space. However, this would not happen if the extra dimensions ended on another brain not that far away from the brain on which we live. Then, for distances greater than the separation of the brains, gravity would not be able to spread out freely, but would effectively be confined to the brain, like the electric forces, and fall off at the right rate for planetary orbits. On the other hand, for distances less than the separation of the brains, gravity would vary more rapidly. The very small gravitational field between heavy objects has been measured accurately in the lab, but the experiments so far would not have detected the effects of brains separated by less than a few inches. New measurements are now being made at shorter distances. In this brain world, we would live on one brain, but there would be another shadow brain nearby. Because light would be confined to the brains and would not propagate through the space between, we couldn't see the shadow world, but we would feel the gravitational influence of matter on the shadow brain. In our brain, such gravitational forces would appear to be produced by sources that were truly dark, in that the only way we could detect them is through their gravity. In fact, in order to explain the rate at which stars orbit the center of our galaxy, it seems there must be more mass than is accounted for by the matter we observe. Evidence for dark matter. Various cosmological observations strongly suggest that there should be much more matter in our galaxy and other galaxies than we see. The most convincing of these observations is that stars on the outskirts of spiral galaxies, like our own Milky Way, orbit far too fast to be held in their orbits only by the gravitational attraction of all the stars we observe. We've known, since the 1970s, that there is a discrepancy between the observed rotational velocities of stars in the outer regions of spiral galaxies and the orbit velocities that one would expect, according to Newton's laws, from the distribution of the visible stars in the galaxy. This indicates that there should be much more matter in the outer parts of the spiral galaxies. The nature of dark matter. Cosmologists now believe that while the central parts of spiral galaxies consist largely of ordinary stars, their outskirts are dominated by dark matter that we can't see directly. One of the fundamental problems for cosmology today is to discover the dominant form of dark matter in the outer regions of galaxies. Before the 1980s, it was usually assumed that this dark matter was ordinary matter comprised of protons, neutrons, and electrons in some not readily detectable form, perhaps gas clouds or MACHOs, massive compact halo objects like white dwarfs or neutron stars or even black holes. However, recent study of the formation of galaxies has led cosmologists to believe that a significant fraction of the dark matter must be in a different form from ordinary matter. Perhaps it arises from the masses of very light elementary particles such as axions and neutrinos. It may even consist of more exotic species of particles such as WIMPs, that are predicted by modern theories of elementary particles, but have not yet been detected experimentally. This missing mass might arise from some exotic species of particle in our world, such as WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles, or axions, very light elementary particles. But missing mass could also be evidence of the existence of a shadow world with matter in it. Maybe it contains shallow human beings, wondering about the mass that seems to be missing from their world to account for the orbits of shadow stars around the center of the shadow galaxy. Instead of the extra dimension ending on a second brain, another possibility is that they are infinite but highly curved, like a saddle. Lisa Randall and Raman Sundram showed that this kind of curvature would act like a second brain. The gravitational influence of an object on the brain would be confined to a small neighborhood of the brain, and not spread out to infinity in the extra dimensions. Like in the shadow brain model, the gravitational field would have the right long-distance fall-off to explain planetary orbits and lab measurements of the gravitational force, but gravity would vary more rapidly at short distances. There is, however, an important difference between this Randall syndrome model and the shadow brain model. Bodies that move under the influence of gravity will produce gravitational waves, ripples of curvature that travel through space-time at the speed of light. Like the electromagnetic waves of light, gravitational waves should carry energy, a prediction that has been confirmed by observations of the binary pulsar PSR. Binary pulsars. General relativity predicts that heavy bodies moving under the influence of gravity emit gravitational waves. Like light waves, gravitational waves carry energy away from the objects that emit them. However, the rate of energy loss is usually extremely low, hence very difficult to observe. For instance, the emission of gravitational waves is causing the Earth to slowly spiral in toward the Sun, but it will take another 10 to the 27th power years for them to collide. But in 1975, Russell Hulse and Joseph Taylor discovered the binary pulsar PSR 1913+16, a system consisting of two compact neutron stars orbiting each other with a maximum separation of only one solar radius. According to general relativity, the rapid motion means that the orbital period of the system should decrease on a much shorter timescale because of the emission of a strong gravitational wave signal. The change predicted by general relativity is in excellent agreement with careful observations by Hulse and Taylor of the orbital parameters, which indicate that since 1975, the period has shortened by more than 10 seconds. In 1993, they were awarded the Nobel Prize for this confirmation of general relativity. If we indeed live on a brain in a space-time with extra dimensions, gravitational waves generated by the motion of bodies on the brain would travel off into the other dimensions. They would be reflected back if there were a second shadow brain and trapped between the two brains. On the other hand, if there was only a single brain and the extra dimensions went on forever, like in the Randall syndrome model, gravitational waves could escape altogether and carry away energy from our brain world. This would seem to breach one of the fundamental principles of physics, the law of conservation of energy. The total amount of energy remains the same. However, it appears to be a violation only because our view of what is happening is restricted to the brain. An angel, who could see the extra dimensions, would know that the energy was the same, just more spread out. The gravitational waves produced by two stars orbiting each other would have a wavelength which would be much longer than the radius of the saddle-shaped curvature in the extra dimensions. This would mean they would tend to be confined to a small neighborhood of the brain, like gravitational force, and wouldn't spread out much into the extra dimensions or carry away much energy from the brain. On the other hand, gravitational waves that were shorter than the scale on which the extra dimensions are curved would escape easily from the vicinity of the brain. The only sources of significant amounts of short gravitational waves are likely to be black holes. A black hole on the brain will extend to a black hole in the extra dimensions. If the black hole is small, it will be almost round. That is, it will reach about as far into the extra dimensions as its size on the brain. On the other hand, a large black hole on the brain will extend to a black pancake, which is confined to a vicinity of the brain and which is much less thick in the extra dimensions than it is wide on the brain. As explained in Chapter 4, quantum theory means that black holes won't be completely black. They'll emit particles and radiation of all kinds, like hot bodies. The particles and radiation like light would be emitted along the brain because matter and non-gravitational forces like electricity would be confined to the brain. However, black holes also emit gravitational waves. These would not be confined to the brain, but would travel in the extra dimension as well. If the black hole was large and pancake-like, the gravitational waves would stay near the brain. This would mean that the black hole would lose energy, and therefore mass, by E equals mc squared, at the rate one would expect for a black hole in four-dimensional space-time. The black hole would therefore slowly evaporate and shrink in size until it became smaller than the radius of curvature of the saddle-like extra dimensions. At this point, the gravitational waves emitted by the black hole would begin to escape freely into the extra dimensions. To someone on the brain, the black hole, or dark star as Mitchell called it, would appear to be emitting dark radiation. Radiation that can't be observed directly on the brain, but whose existence could be inferred from the fact that the black hole was losing mass. It would mean that the final burst of radiation from an evaporating black hole would appear less powerful than it actually was. This could be why we've not observed bursts of gamma rays that can be ascribed to dying black holes, though the other, more prosaic explanation would be that there aren't many black holes with mass low enough to evaporate at the age of the universe so far. The radiation from brain world black holes arises from quantum fluctuations of particles on and off a brain, but brains, like everything else in the universe, will be subject to quantum fluctuations themselves. These can cause brains to appear and disappear spontaneously. The quantum creation of a brain would be a bit like the formation of bubbles of steam in boiling water. Liquid water consists of billions and billions of H2O molecules packed together with couplings between nearest neighbors. As the water is heated up, the molecules move faster and bounce off each other. Occasionally, these collisions will give molecules such high velocities that a group of them will break free of their bonds and form a little bubble of steam surrounded by water. The bubble will then grow or shrink in a random manner, with more molecules from the liquid joining the steam or vice versa. Most small bubbles of steam will collapse to liquid again, but a few will grow to a certain critical size, beyond which the bubbles are almost certain to continue to grow. It is these large expanding bubbles that one observes when water boils. The behavior of brain worlds would be similar. The uncertainty principle would allow brain worlds to appear from nothing as bubbles, with the brain forming the surface of the bubble, and the interior being the higher dimensional space. Very small bubbles would tend to collapse again to nothing, but a bubble that grew by quantum fluctuations beyond a certain critical size would be likely to keep on growing. People, such as us, living on the brain, the surface of the bubble, would think the universe was expanding. It would be like painting galaxies on the surface of a balloon and blowing it up. The galaxies would move apart, but no galaxy would be picked out as the center of expansion. Let's hope there's no one with a cosmic pin to deflate the bubble. According to the no-boundary proposal described in Chapter 3, the spontaneous creation of a brain world would have a history in imaginary time, which was like a nutshell. That is, it would be a four-dimensional sphere like the surface of the Earth, but with two more dimensions. The important difference is that the nutshell described in Chapter 3 was essentially hollow. The four-dimensional sphere wouldn't have been the boundary of anything, and the other six or seven dimensions of space-time that M-theory predicts would all be curled up even smaller than the nutshell. On the new brain world picture, however, the nutshell would be filled. The history, in imaginary time, of the brain on which we live would be a four-dimensional sphere which would be the boundary of a five-dimensional bubble, with the remaining five or six dimensions curled up very small. This history of the brain in imaginary time would determine its history in real time. In real time, the brain would expand in an accelerated inflationary manner like that described in Chapter 3. A perfectly smooth and round nutshell would be the most probable history of the bubble in imaginary time. However, it would correspond to a brain that expanded forever in an inflationary way in real time. Galaxies wouldn't form on such a brain, and so intelligent life would not have developed. On the other hand, imaginary time histories that are not perfectly smooth and round would have somewhat lower probabilities, but could correspond to real-time behavior in which the brain had a phase of accelerating inflationary expansion at first, but then began to slow down. During this decelerating expansion, galaxies could have formed and intelligent life might have developed. Thus, according to the anthropic principle described in Chapter 3, it is only the slightly hairy nutshells which will be observed by intelligent beings asking why the origin of the universe wasn't perfectly smooth. As the brain expanded, the volume of the higher dimensional space inside would increase. Eventually, there would be an enormous bubble surrounded by the brain on which we live. But do we really live on the brain? According to the idea of holography described in Chapter 2, information about what happens in a region of space-time can be encoded on its boundary. So maybe we think we live in a four-dimensional world because we are shadows cast on the brain by what is happening in the interior of the bubble. However, from a positivist viewpoint, one can't ask which is reality, brain or bubble. They are both mathematical models that describe the observations. One is free to use whichever model is most convenient. What is outside the brain? There are several possibilities. One, there may be nothing outside. Although a bubble of steam has water outside it, this is just an analogy to help us visualize the origin of the universe. One could imagine a mathematical model that was just a brain with a higher dimensional space inside, but absolutely nothing outside, not even empty space. One can calculate what the mathematical model predicts without reference to what is outside. Two, one could have a mathematical model in which the outside of a bubble was glued to the outside of a similar bubble. This model is actually mathematically equivalent to the possibility discussed above, that there is nothing outside the bubble. But the difference is psychological. People feel happier being placed in the center of space-time rather than on its edge. But for a positivist, possibilities one and two are the same. Three, the bubble might expand into a space that was not a mirror image of what was inside the bubble. This possibility is different to the two discussed above and is more like the case of boiling water. Other bubbles could form and expand. If they collided and merged with the bubble in which we lived, the results could be catastrophic. It has even been suggested that the Big Bang itself may have been produced by a collision between brains. Brain world models like this are a hot topic of research. They're highly speculative, but they offer new kinds of behavior which can be tested by observation. They could explain why gravity seems to be so weak. Gravity might be quite strong in the fundamental theory, but the spreading of the gravitational force in the extra dimensions would mean it would be weak at large distances on the brain on which we live. A consequence of this would be that the Planck length, the smallest distance to which we can probe without creating a black hole, would be quite a lot larger than it would appear from the weakness of gravity on our four-dimensional brain. The smallest Russian doll wouldn't be so tiny after all, and might be within the reach of particle accelerators of the future. In fact, we might already have discovered the smallest doll, the fundamental Planck length, if the US hadn't gone through a fit of feeling poor in 1994 and cancelled the SSC, the superconducting supercollider, even though it was half-built. Other particle accelerators, such as the LHC, Large Hadron Collider at Geneva, are now being built. With them and other observations, such as the cosmic microwave background radiation, we may be able to determine whether or not we live on a brain. If we do, it will presumably be because the anthropic principle picks out brain models from the vast zoo of universes allowed by M-theory. We could well paraphrase Miranda in Shakespeare's The Tempest. O brain, new world, that has such creatures in it. That is the universe in a nutshell. This is Simon Preble. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Universe in a Nutshell by Stephen Hawking. This program was produced and directed by Paul Rubin. Executive producer, Laura Wilson. Text copyright 2001 by Stephen Hawking. Production copyright 2001, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.